We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
For a long, long time, those suffering from mental illness or even suspected of mental illness or a disability would be locked up in an asylum. Often they were just forgotten. It was even worse for African Americans, especially those in the South during the Jim Crow era. Peabody and Emmy Award-winning NBC News journalist Antonia Hilton has chronicled what black patients and workers faced at Crownsville State Hospital in Maryland in her new book, Madness, Race, and Insanity in a Jim Crow Asylum. Antonia Hilton joins us today on The Spark. Ms. Hilton, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what inspired you to write the book?
Well, I think something very simple. I grew up in a very big family, and we had a lot of trouble talking about mental health. We were very close and a very tight-knit family, but the one thing that always seemed off limits was any discussion of emotions. Anytime you noticed an older relative who may have been struggling with something, you know, I knew that there was a history of depression or alcoholism in parts of my family, but we really just didn't address it. And so as I got older and I took more opportunities through school and in my own life to just explore, I became a bit obsessed with the history of mental health and the history of psychiatry. I think it all came from that very personal longing and that search. And so as a college student, I decided to study the history of psychiatry, and I came across information about this place called Crownsville Hospital, founded in 1911, but it didn't close until 2004, within our lifetimes. And I just knew when I first read just a few sentences about it that I had to know more. And I kind of used this site as a place to not just contribute to what we know about mental health and civil rights in this country, but also really to better understand why in my family and why in so many communities of color, there is this longstanding shame and stigma around these issues. Why has it become so hard to address it and talk about it? And Crownsville and its story has really become my way to make sense of it all.
Do you think that stigma still exists today? Or I guess what I'm asking is it less so of a stigma? Reason being, since the pandemic, we've heard a lot about mental illness and more people talking about it. Is it still that way, that big of a stigma, especially in the African-American community?
I think that a lot of strides have been made, but there is a long, long way to go, particularly for older Americans, but also for men. There's a lot slower uptake for these services. They're a lot more fearful about trying out therapy. And in some ways, that's not their fault. You know, if you're in many communities in the United States, it is very hard to find a quality therapist or psychiatrist right now. Coming out of the pandemic, many of them are reporting that they have very long waiting lists, even worse if you're a child, because there's so few child psychiatrists. Now add to that if you have a language barrier. Now add to that if you have you know, a concern that involves your race or particular cultural background, you're going to have an even harder time. Only about 2% of American psychiatrists are Black. So for family members of mine who went searching specifically for that, they knew they wanted to talk about race in America. They wanted to talk about some of their concerns and their fears, especially during the pandemic, during George Floyd. They had a very, very hard time finding people who really knew and understood and could support them through that. I write at one point in the book, actually, about a loved one of mine who really struggled as they experienced a serious mental health issue to get connected to good care, and how they felt rejected by doctors who didn't really want to have those conversations with them. And that's happening in our current moment still. And so absolutely, you know, I would never say that what we have right now is the same as what was there in 1911 when a place like Crownsville Hospital was created, but we still have a very long way to go. And the problem is that the practices that were set up more than a century ago, they actually still impact people's decision to access healthcare because of the traditions, the stigmas, the fears that get passed on. That's part of the focus of the book, actually, is the way in which oral history informs what we know about this place, but also the way that stories passed on by family members affect the way that we then see these systems, see doctors, and choose or choose not to take part in the healthcare system.
As you mentioned, Crownsville was open for 93 years, opened in 1911. I can't go on without even mentioning how it was built, because that was unique.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I always tell people that the origin story of Crownsville is at once very strange, but also very American. So this place is created in 1911 after doctors and politicians, all of whom are white in the state of Maryland, have kind of been debating their different theories about why so many African Americans seem to be struggling after slavery. And for some of them, it's not the experience of enslavement that seems to have caused them so much mental trauma. To them, it's actually that is the good old days, that's the way we should have been doing things. And the absence of that system and the structure that came with it seems to have been bad for Black people's mental health. So then they create all these different segregated asylums. But at Crownsville, they make this decision and they don't really want to pay for it. So they come up with this idea to make the patients build the hospital themselves. So they march, at first it's 12 Black men, into a forest in the heart of Anne Arundel County, Maryland. That's the county that Annapolis is the seat of. And these men start the backbreaking work of clearing a forest, constructing roads, moving a railway, creating a foundation, and helping to build these massive brick structures that actually still stand to this day. If you're ever driving through the Crownsville area of Maryland, you can go down Crownsville Road, and right from that road, you can see all of these structures that are still there. And to me, you know, in the early days of doing this research, just that visual, that image was so shocking to me, that patients could be forced to create their own hospital before they could even benefit from their own health care. The way in which Black patients were treated so differently and seen as deserving so much less than everybody else. But also it raised these questions for me, right, of how sick can somebody be? You know, they're apparently so sick that they need to be removed from society. They need to be institutionalized, but they're so healthy that they can do around the clock physical labor. At points, officials are writing about even forcing children to do this labor as young as 10 and 12 years old, some of whom are physically disabled, missing limbs, and they are part of the construction project as well. And so it raised all these questions about how someone can be seen as so sick, but also be such a talented craftsman and contractor, apparently. They can build buildings that still stand 100 plus years later. That to me has always really stuck in my mind.
Well, that wasn't the only work that those at Crownsville, those who were patients, did. I mean, they worked on a lot of different things. It was a farm. They were even rented out. I mean, that sounds like slavery itself.
I mean, you hit it right there. That's essentially the structure that you see these early doctors recreate. So they make the patients build the hospital themselves. Then they make them run a massive, highly productive, and very modern farm. They use modern irrigation systems. And I found in the records that the patients at Crownsville are producing way more than any other patients at other peer hospitals that are larger than Crownsville. So the white counterparts have actually more patients because the white population in Maryland is larger, but they are doing less than the patients at Crownsville are. In addition to that, they're running a rug shop, they're doing a basket weaving program, and all of this is done to offset the cost of their own care. And so it sets up something, and this kind of brings you back to my point about the way in which the eras that come before us really impact us to this day. So because in those early years, the hospital never gets the amount of funding that it was supposed to get if you compare it to its other institutions, and it relies so heavily on patients really running the place themselves, that kind of mistreatment, that gap, is never really made up for. Even in the later decades, when that forced servitude and sort of constant labor stops, and they're trying to professionalize and become a kind of normal hospital, they're still decades behind everyone else because they hadn't invested in infrastructure. They don't have all the same resources. They're way understaffed compared to other hospitals. And so the decisions made in those early years to make the hospital really like a plantation, sort of the recreation of the antebellum social order, even when we get to, say, the 60s and 70s, and there are all these reforms and new Black employees are coming in and they're changing the game, and all of that's good and fine. The truth is they're really up against a very difficult opponent, systematically, I mean, because they're looking at decades of deprivation that they really don't have the opportunity to fully make up for. And that affects the hospital all the way until it's closing.
You know, today Maryland is considered a fairly progressive state. And those who may not be familiar with the history may not think of Maryland as the South or a Jim Crow state. What was Maryland like in the early to mid 20th century?
Yeah, well, one thing I remind people is that Maryland never joined the Confederacy, but there were a whole lot of people who had understanding, compassion, and affection for the Confederacy,
and
or who had even wanted Maryland to join it.
And it was a slave state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what I tell people about those early years is actually Maryland is a fascinating place to look at the history of this country, because in many parts of Maryland, there were some of the largest populations of free Black people in the years as slavery was coming to an end and of course, right after. And those populations were causing a lot of friction and intense conflict and backlash. And so, you know, there's all this conversation and criticism and alarm when slaves are emancipated for decades, not just for a couple years at the end of the 19th century, but well into the 20th century, where still doctors are publishing in papers, politicians are talking about what are they going to do about the problem of African-Americans in certain communities. That's kind of the tone with which they talk about them. At one point, I show a record in the book where they are remarking that some of the African-American populations there are being treated as worse than beasts of the field. And this is as we're getting close to 1911, when the hospital is going to, you know, open up. And so, you know, there is extreme racial violence still. There are lynchings happening along the Eastern Shore. Black communities are being barred systematically from jobs. So Crownsville opens, but Black people aren't able to so much as get jobs as cooks or cleaners there. It's an all-white staff and an all-Black patient population. And so the Black communities there are incredibly impoverished and segregated. And I look at the community aspect as well in this book, because I felt it was very important for you to not just, you know, this isn't a ghost tale about an asylum where you're just going to stay within its walls. I'm really going to try to make you understand how this hospital is so reflective. It's really a story about this country's psyche, about the history of Maryland and about the shaping of our country and all our fights to live up to the promises we made to all of our citizens. And so that required me at points to take you into other neighborhoods in Baltimore and Annapolis along the Eastern Shore and to look at really the larger racial context there. And the ways in which the Black employees who eventually arrived and many wonderful white employees there really had to take some of these battles on for themselves and find ways to change the culture, to save patient lives, to show love and humanity after decades of this community being looked at as less than human in Maryland, but also beyond.
I want to go back to something you mentioned very much up front when we were talking about your family history. Your father's cousin Maynard, tell us about him.
My father had a cousin Maynard who grew up in Mobile, Alabama, while my father and his family was in Detroit, Michigan. And Maynard was my father's North Star. A cousin that he loved and looked up to and really wanted to be. And my dad always tells me the story of his cousin coming up from Mobile up to Detroit to visit one summer in the 70s. And Maynard wanted to be a lawyer like my grandfather. And my father just watched Maynard every day, you know, go out into the city and explore. He loved to talk about politics and civil rights. He carried around an autographed copy of Malcolm X's autobiography. And he really just spoke with passion about Black power and identity and really wanted my dad and all of his brothers and cousins to believe that they could be anything that they could be. And my dad was very young. You know, he's 11 around this time in the 70s. And he doesn't know it, but his cousin is starting to experience a mental health crisis. And it turns out that Maynard is developing schizophrenia and having delusions or hallucinations that he is going to be harmed imminently. And, you know, for years, my family sort of observes him starting to struggle in the 70s but they really don't know what to do. They actually do not know the word schizophrenia. They don't know what this disease is. They don't know how to help. They see it as a family secret, not something that requires healthcare necessarily. And I think a lot of families can relate to that, the confusion that you feel when you first start to find out that someone is struggling in that way. And that confusion was very palpable, especially decades ago. And eventually, my father gets a phone call, and they find out that Maynard has been shot by a police officer, killed on the steps of the federal building in Mobile, Alabama, in the midst of a mental health crisis. So he is, you know, he's in a lot of pain and anguish, and he wants someone to take him out of the country. And according to a police officer in Alabama, Maynard runs at him and has a firearm on him. And that's when they decide to shoot. And his death changed my father, changed my whole family. And I felt it was really important to write about it in the book, because part of what I'm asking other people to do in the book is talk more about their family stories, to destigmatize these things, to actually still talk about the lives of our loved ones who have suffered in this way, and not just talk about their worst moments or their death. Because I think that's so often what these stories become. And so I kind of wanted to reconstruct Maynard and remind you of how interesting and funny, athletic, inspiring he was, what he meant to my father and everybody around him. And in addition to that, help you see the connections between race and the anxiety and the pain that the racism that Maynard experienced and the segregation that he felt and he saw in the South at that time, how that compounded and interacted with his mental health issues. And, you know, what I live with now is a family that in many ways is still coming to terms with all of that. Only in recent years have people started talking more about Maynard, showing his photos. I mean, when I was a kid, they hid photos of Maynard because it was so painful for people to see him and to relive those memories. And so now my family has really been on this journey of rediscovery, of reckoning, of supporting and talking instead of hiding and erasing. And part of that has been to talk more about Maynard, to bring his story to the forefront instead of pushing it behind the curtain. And my hope is that more families do have the opportunity to do things like this, to celebrate and not live in the shame of having someone who struggled with their mental health.
Yeah, it's a powerful example and great inspiration for getting people to talk about what is in their family. Patients at Crownsville, getting back to Crownsville, were there patients in Crownsville who weren't mentally ill or maybe didn't have a disability, or that the justice system said, oh, this person is a criminal or they've been convicted of a crime, suspected of a crime, and they were sent to a mental hospital instead?
Oh my gosh, yes. And that's something so important to know about Crownsville, but also many mental institutions. They became in some ways receptacles for kind of anyone who was seen as outside of the norm, unable to get with the status quo, or just unwanted by someone or by parts of their community. And so what I found in the records really disturbed me at times. I write about the story of one patient who's sent to Crownsville and ends up there for decades for the crime of cutting a white person off in traffic. At another point, I write about a patient named Mr. Bell, who is discovered by one of the first ever Black employees who arrives in the early 50s. And she finds this man on the wards who tells her that he hasn't been outside, he hasn't seen the sun in many years. So she does a little research on him and she takes him outside one day. And she finds out that her own supervisor had picked him up downtown in Baltimore because he had overheard the patient speaking in a British accent. And the man didn't think that there were Black people who could have British accents. And so he thought, oh, he's, you know, crazy. And so he gets committed to Crownsville sort of in the cover of night and stuck there for years with no relatives. And it turns out after she does some research that this man was a jockey from London and had come to the United States and fell on some hard times. And it's stories like that that really changed me and helped me see the way in which in some ways, the asylum was almost an appendage to the criminal justice system or into almshouses and wasn't always truly this therapeutic place.
Unbelievable. That is just, as I read the book, I remember Mr. Bell very well. So we only have about 90 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So what do you want readers to take away from the book?
Well, thank you for having me. I think the main thing I want readers to take from this is first that if you are dealing with a mental health challenge or you have loved ones who are, that you should feel like you are not alone. You should know that the shame can be lifted from your shoulders, that this book includes stories of hope and recovery from patients who, in spite of all the challenges that I've described, actually made it through and were able to contribute and be part of their community and still are to this day. And then I also think that people should know that, you know, many of the systems and what we've kind of been left behind with here, they were choices, and choices can be undone. And so if you're unhappy with the current mental health care system, know that there are so many organizations, programs, and doctors fighting for something better, and that all of us could listen a little bit more to them. We could fight for the policies that they believe would bring change, and we don't have to accept the status quo, the way that things are right now, where so many families, Black, white, and of every background, creed, and belief, are feeling like they are so alienated from, so unsupported, so unable to get the care that they need. These are choices, and the good news is that choices can be changed. Mm.
Antonia Hilton is the author of Madness, Race, and Insanity in a Jim Crow Asylum. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.